Since this is a podcast, you can only hear me right now. But if you could see me, you'd be saying, whoa, who is that? It's me, Katie Helper. I'm just wearing the new fashion line from American Giant. Since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic full zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. Right now, I'm wearing the very stylish moto dress, perfect for feeling sporty and sleek, made with their soft and stretchy French terry fabric, and Aaron got the roughneck chore jacket, so he's looking good throughout his endlessly busy schedule. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use the code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. As you know far too well from listening to Useful Idiots, the 2024 election is coming fast. And while we can't predict for sure which candidate will win, we do know that either way, everyone else in the world will lose. Unless there was a fun and easy way to make a little extra cash on the whole terrible contest. That's right, betting's not just for sports fans anymore. Now it's the political junkies' time to shine. We figured that if we spend all our time on Twitter anyway, following the election and endless political analysis, why not put our knowledge to the test? It's MyBookie, a new sports book that lets you bet on the 2024 election from the general election down to who will win each state. If the world is crashing anyway, why not cash in? Don't miss out on this. Pick a side. Use promo code USEFUL to double your first deposit and instantly start with a leg up, only with MyBookie.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Aaron Matte.
I'm Katie Helper.
And we have an exciting show this week as we continue to live on the brink of Armageddon in these exciting times. Katie, how is your, near Armageddon going for you?
I'm just not thinking about it, basically. Yeah, how I'm coping.
You? Fair enough. Yeah, I think it's a wise choice. Yeah, it's wise. Well, luckily we have the four food groups to keep us going. And this week, what do we have for Democrats Suck?
So for Democrats Suck, we have an interesting little story that I came across from Braxton Brew on Twitter, who writes a lot about student debt. So I'm just going to read his tweet. It says, you can't make this up. The Department of Education estimates it'll cost $99,900,000 to operate the application for student debt cancellation. They would literally rather spend $100 million on means testing than just canceling the debt automatically. So, means testing is already a pretty disgusting thing for various reasons we can get into. But I do think it's interesting that it is so costly to administer means testing.
So to cancel the debt, it's going to cost at least $99 million?
Yes, that is it. That's true. That's what they're going to. Well, only because they're means testing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And can you explain what that means to mean test for people?
Yeah, means testing means you have to apply and you have to reach meet certain criteria. A lot of people wanted this to just be across the board cancellation without having to meet criteria, which is, of course, what should happen, because when you do things like this, it's better to have kind of blanket cancellations, because then people are less stigmatized and it becomes something that's kind of a universal right, as opposed to something that only certain people can access.
And that's what it initially was billed as, right? It was supposed to be pretty much across the board with very few exceptions, right? But they kind of, then they're like, actually we're going to make this only eligible for a small number of people.
Yeah. It's really gross.
Yeah. All right.
But well, that's not surprising.
Not surprising, because Democrats suck.
Because Democrats suck indeed.
Yeah. Well, so for Republicans suck, look, a lot of exciting races right now ahead of the midterms. And we have an interesting one in Ohio featuring J.D. Vance versus Tim Ryan. And they had a debate where weighing in on the very, topical and divisive issue of drug criminalization. And this is what J.D. Vance, the Republican candidate, shared in terms of his thoughts.
Okay, so one, I think it should be a state's issue. States should make these decisions. Second, I don't want anybody going to prison for smoking a joint. That's not at all what I want to do. The third thing is we got to be careful here not to be soft on crime, because a lot of times you'll hear somebody thrown in prison for smoking a joint, which I, like I just said, I don't think that's a good idea. That's not something that we should be doing. But that's just true on paper. And if you look at the underlying charge, you'll see it wasn't just that they smoked a joint. It's that they smoked a joint and then beat an elderly woman over the head with a pistol. Those people should go to prison, and just having pled down to a so-called nonviolent drug offense, they should still be going to jail. We have to be careful about how we do this. We don't want to be soft on crime for people like that.
We want to be hard on them. We want to beat them over the head with a pistol. Hard on them.
I've never heard of that before, where somebody beats an elderly person over the head with a pistol, but then pleads down to a marijuana charge. I mean, I don't know.
If they do, good on their lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fantastic legal skills right there. Yeah. If you can play down from that. But yeah, I mean, usually marijuana doesn't induce people to beat people over the head, and induces them to play video games or riff on their guitar or eat food, you know, get the munchies. But
maybe what if the grandmother came in and disconnected their amp or their video game, and then in a fit of pot-induced fury, that person whipped out a pistol, beat Graham over the head.
That probably was the very argument that won the case to be pled down. That's very convincing. I would accept that sentence reduction right there for sure. If I heard that alibi.
So J.D. Vance is onto something.
Yeah. All right, J.D. Vance. Fair enough. Touche.
Well, so for Isn't That Weird, we have a kind of charming, kind of weird, kind of problematic, if I'm being honest, story about a bear, fat bear competition. You know, it's interesting. Last week, we had a cheating scandal that rocked the fishing weight world. This week, we have a cheating scandal. This was a voting scandal that rocked the bear, fat bear world.
It's that time of year again. Fat Bear Week is back and bulkier than ever.
Hey.
Sorry, buddy, but it's true.
Still rude.
The fun fan favorite competition is an annual collaboration between the National Park Service and Alaska's Katmai National Park to celebrate these titans of tubbiness and champs of chubbiness during their season of pre-hibernation weight gain. As always, voters can download a bracket of the hefty heavyweights going head-to-head, but this year there are some robust features as well, like an interactive slider that lets you marvel at the bear's amazing transformations, and even a junior fat bear competition that let voters wet their wild animal weight gain whistle ahead of the big fat main event.
Now, it came down to two chubby bears, but the winner of the competition was, let's show people who the winner was, Wilson. 747 is cleared for landing. Introducing your 2022 Fat Bear Week champion. Let's take a look at this guy. He's pretty cute and pretty chubby. Looks pretty prepared for winter. I think he's peeing right there. Struggling. Probably harder to lift himself up with all that extra heft. But there was a cheating scandal. Someone spam voted. And luckily, the people who run this competition were hip to it. They realized there was a spam issue. They realized that one of the bears' votes shot up very suddenly. And it could have actually destroyed the integrity of this election. But luckily, they were aware of it and they were able to spot it. They don't want to reveal exactly how the person did it because they don't want to train these cheaters. They don't want to give away any hints, but they were able to, they now include one of those like capture things where you have to write the word out to make sure that you're not a robot. So the good news is that we can be confident that the actual winner won.
Well, that's reassuring.
It is. Yeah.
You know, I'm just wondering, you know how like when we refer to like powerful lobby groups, like big tobacco, big pharma. So is the bear lobby, is it Big Bear?
It is bear. It's big fat bear.
Big fat bear. Yeah.
And I like that these bears are rewarded. I think this is good. It's not, you know, it's not body shaming. It's kind of encouraging full figuredness. It's embracing it's encouraging bears to embrace their Rubenesque nature, which is important in this era of body shaming. No eating disorders for these guys. All right. So that's weird, but uplifting.
Weird bit of lifting. All right. So for Isn't That Terrible, we have yet another admission from a prominent neocon that the U.S. is using Ukraine to fight Russia and is fighting Russia to the last Ukrainian. This has been, you know, the talking point of progressive critics like us for a long time. But now you have more and more people who support the proxy war saying it. We heard Lindsey Graham say it. And the latest to basically say it is retired General Jack Keane speaking on Fox News.
There are people in the Congress, and some of them Republicans, who have always expressed some concern about spending in terms of spending money on Ukraine. But, you know, we've got a $6 trillion budget. It's actually larger than that by a few hundred billion. And we've invested, and I mean invested, $66 billion in Ukraine this year. And that's like 1.1%. And what are we getting for that? For $66 billion, what we're getting is Ukraine is doing the fighting. They are literally destroying the Russian army on the battlefield, which would set them back for years and deny them the ability to ever accomplish under Putin any of his ambitions in terms of taking back some of the Soviet republics. And by the way, if that happened, that would mean war with NATO and Russia. And the scale of that would be much greater than what it is right now. And the risk, certainly, of nuclear war would be much greater. It's something we have avoided all through the Cold War, a conventional war with two superpowers holding strategic nuclear weapons. So for this investment, I think it's well worth it.
So this is a great investment. We're paying only $66 billion.
It's a bargain.
It's a bargain. Bargain investment. It's a great deal. And he's also saying that doing this proxy war actually avoids a larger war with Russia, a nuclear war in the future. So yes, sure, Biden's talking about Armageddon and there's nuclear threats being hurled from different corners. But this is all just really a way to avoid all that by fighting right now. It's like a down payment now on avoiding something far worse in the future, according to his logic.
I mean, what do you think of that argument, by the way? Because I think it's an argument that people believe in strongly enough to say out loud.
Well, first of all, okay, look, let's say Putin was crazy enough to want to invade a NATO state, right? As Keane says he is. We've seen how much of a hard time Russia has had invading Ukraine, which is a country right on its border and where it even has allies. I mean, the rebels in the Donbass, Russia has been backing for the last 8 years. And still, Russia has been having a very, very hard time. So even if Putin was crazy enough to want to invade NATO states and set off a world war, he's shown in Ukraine that he doesn't have the capacity to militarily. So none of this makes sense. And the idea that, you know, he'll be emboldened to invade other NATO countries if he succeeds in Ukraine, it's just that means you're ignoring everything that Russia has proposed before this war began to try to avoid the war. The point in Ukraine was to prevent Ukraine from becoming another NATO proxy. Now, they've already accepted the NATO proxies that exist. They just don't want another one, especially in a country where there's millions of people who identify with Russia and as parts of the country that used to be a part of Russia long ago. And those parts now Russia has just annexed again. But so the idea that like somehow Ukraine is like the first step to go elsewhere, I think is just ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, you heard it here first.
Yeah. But it's terrible. It's terrible. But it's also great that it's admitted because it's helpful for people to understand what really is guiding the U.S. behind this conflict.
Right. They really pulled back the curtain.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it is frustrating because the way that like Putin has been turned into this Hitler makes it seem like all the rules of negotiation or diplomacy or engagement are off the table.
Yes. And on that note, check out what was just published in the Washington Post, which says this, quote, privately, U.S. officials say neither Russia nor Ukraine is capable of winning the war outright. But they have ruled out the idea of pushing or even nudging Ukraine to the negotiating table. That is an amazing admission, but very telling. So privately, U.S. officials are saying that neither Russia nor Ukraine is capable of winning. So they know that Ukraine is not capable of winning, but yet still they're not willing to push them or even nudge them to the negotiating table. And that's because the policy is, as Jack Keane laid out there, the policy is just to use Ukraine to fight Russia, to weaken Russia. It's not actually to help Ukraine win, which they know privately Ukraine cannot do. So basically, the U.S. policy is just endless war and sacrificing as many Ukrainians as it takes. That's what they're privately admitting.
That's so disgusting.
But that's where it's at. And unless some sort of force rises up in the U.S. to promote diplomacy, except for like, I don't know, a small fringe of the Republican Party, which aren't exactly even promoting diplomacy. They're just condemning Biden and voting against the war. Then we're going to see this go on for a very long time. And right now there's no organized force, certainly inside the Democratic Party, that wants to push Biden to negotiate. So he has no incentive politically to change his policy, at least right now.
And it's so disgusting because people who care about Ukrainians, and we all know that that's a very popular, I mean, it's not like people shouldn't care about Ukrainians, but as many people have pointed out, there's empathy and sympathy and solidarity for Ukrainians that we never see for Palestinians or Yemenis. But all those people should be up in arms about something like this. This kind of revelation should be disturbing to them because endless war is not good for Ukrainians. That literally means more Ukrainians killed.
Yep. Yeah. Well, as I said a long time ago, Russiagate is a hell of a drug. People have been propagandized by years of claims coming from the Democratic Party and their allies in the media that Russia is this evil force that's able to brainwash millions of Americans with their troll farms into not voting for Hillary Clinton. And now is carrying out this genocidal war in Ukraine and so can't be negotiated with. There's no point. Even diplomacy, people have been conditioned to believe that. People have not been told that actually there have been negotiations, which, as we've covered, the U.S. ultimately sabotaged. People don't know that because their media just won't tell them. So in that situation, there's very little freedom that people have to come to a conclusion that is outside of the proxy war aims of those in power.
And Aaron, what you're trying to do is you are trying to take all these people who have ingested the Russiagate drug and you want to lock them up into a room until they go through the sweats and the shakes and kick the habit.
Exactly. Exactly.
Your reporting is methadone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
One-man methadone clinic.
Yeah. I mean, take them down from being at the level of beating, Ukraine and Russia with a pistol. Just get them on a lower marijuana charge, just to draw J.D. Vance's analogy from before.
Right. You know, exactly.
If that makes sense. If that doesn't make sense. Trying to do a callback.
Yeah, no, that was good. That was well done. We are really excited to be talking to Wyatt Reed, a journalist covering Latin America, who is right now in, actually, Donetsk. And he's going to talk about what happened recently, what he's been observing, and also the fact that the hotel he's staying in was hit by a Ukrainian artillery strike.
Yes, and we should say that Wyatt is a correspondent for Sputnik, which is Russian state media. So he is working for the media arm of a belligerent in this conflict. But it's important to hear from everybody and to get his perspective, especially someone who's on the ground, who is hearing right now a perspective that we don't hear about often in US media, really ever, which is that of the people in the Donbass that have been living not just under this war that's been happening since Russia invaded in February, but living under a war that began actually 7 years ago or 8 years ago after the U.S. backed a coup in Ukraine and people in the Donbass took up arms against the coup-backed government. And they've been living under very tough conditions for the last 8 years. And Wyatt is there speaking to people like that who we don't often hear about in U.S. media. And so we're going to hear a bit of that perspective too, which I think is very important.
All right, let's go to Wyatt.
Wyatt Reed, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So Wyatt, you recently posted a video of the aftermath of a strike by Ukrainian forces on Donetsk, where you're reporting from, on your hotel. And you were just very close by when this happened. So let's go to a clip of that and then get you to tell us about what happened.
We're here at the corner of Ottoman Street and Rova Ave. where a artillery strike by the Kiev regime just rocked this intersection. I was about 100 meters away at the time. And as you can see, the devastation is incredible. This is a normal occurrence for the people of Donbass, the people of Donetsk. They are living under this threat every day. And I just got a taste myself. I watched a massive explosion rock this corner. Huge, huge ball of sparks and flames here at my hotel. Shrapnel from the explosion shattered several windows. And that was pretty lucky. I feel pretty lucky right now. If I'd have been 30 seconds, a minute faster to get back to my hotel, I was walking back from a restaurant. If I'd been just a few seconds faster, I would have been killed. It's hard to describe this as anything other than terror tactics. This is fascism in action. And it's why so many people here are deeply appreciative of Russian forces, Russian Federation forces, for finally acting to put an end to this madness that's been happening for 8 years. 8 years of living with this.
So why, tell us about what happened here. Where were you, where this strike hit, and what the situation is where you're reporting from right now in Donetsk?
Right. Well, in many ways, I think that the video kind of speaks for itself. I published that video in the immediate aftermath of basically my first physical interaction with the Ukrainian government. This was not my first interaction, because 2 weeks prior to this video, 2 weeks prior to Saturday night, my first day, my first night in Donetsk, I was placed on the Ukrainian government's official kill list. It's called Mirotvorets. So this was my second kind of physical interaction with the Ukrainian government. And it was terrifying. It was really an impressive sight to behold. To watch up close and personally what people here have been living through for close to 9 years now, it's hard to put it into words. So when that blast went off, I had only been here for about 2 hours. I walked out of my hotel, went to try to go find something to eat. It's very hard to find food past a certain time. There's no water here in Donetsk most of the time. We're living kind of in a war zone, so I knew it was kind of a fool's errand to go out, but I went out anyway, and I'm glad that I went and looked around a little bit further than the first restaurant, because if I had gone back immediately, I very likely would have been right in the middle of that strike when it hit. Instead, I was about 30 seconds, maybe a minute away from the blast radius. I got to watch it from about 100 meters away, just this huge ball. It was like a firework, the most terrifying firework you've ever seen up close, because instead of just shooting sparks, it's shooting hot bits of shrapnel all over the place. It shattered a number of windows on the hotel. Shrapnel went into the front door of the hotel. I watched this from a distance, felt it in my heart, in my body. I had glass rain down all around me from the windows above me that were shattered. And I just went into kind of fight or flight mode. I crouched down and I pulled out my phone and recorded the aftermath. It wasn't that video that we just saw. It was a video that I uploaded a few minutes prior. And, you know, maybe we could play that later. If not, you know, people can find that on my social media. But you really get a sense for kind of the terror that it's like, that one experiences when they go through something like this. I'm basically just cursing constantly for about a minute and not sure what to do. I wanted to go run back into the hotel. I wanted to seek refuge. I think that's just kind of a human instinct. But I had to resist that urge because, which was screaming at me, you know, with every fiber of my being, because people who observe the tactics of the Kiev regime will know this. Others may not, but they frequently employ a tactic that military personnel might refer to as a double tap, which is a follow-up strike. So they wait a few minutes for civilians to gather around to check out the devastation, for first responders to come, and then they strike again to take them out as well. So that was my worry. I didn't want to be caught up in a second strike that might have been coming. But instead I said, well, maybe the second strike hits closer to me. I better just get inside. So I immediately, you know, about 90 seconds later, just sprinted, probably as fast as I've ever run in my life, right into the hotel. The rest of the hotel guests had already been ushered into the bomb shelter in the basement, and all of the staff was down there as well, except for the head of security, and he wanted to usher me in as well. But I wanted to stay up where this is happening and be able to record the reality of the situation. You know, that's why I'm here. I'm here in Donetsk because basically the mainstream media refuses to come here. They refuse to come and show what's happening on the ground, this situation that people have been living through for 8 long years. There is no one else here really from the West. I can count the number of Western journalists on one hand that are here covering this situation. So I felt compelled to basically record the reality that all of these people have been suffering through for so long. And so I waited it out, I stuck it out. And then you saw that video that we just posted where I kind of explained the situation. And as I said, it's kind of hard to put into words what it feels like to be on the receiving end of one of those strikes, to be targeted by this. I do feel targeted personally. It's hard for me to know for sure that I was the specific target, although the fact that I had only been here for about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours at the maximum, the fact that I had just communicated my location through WhatsApp 30 minutes to an hour before this happened. WhatsApp is a notorious app around here. People don't use it because they understand that it's a product of Facebook, which is obviously a U.S. government-aligned tech service. It's filled with ex-CIA officials, ex-FBI officials. It works kind of hand in glove with the U.S. government. So there's a sense that it's being monitored. I can't say for sure whether I was being targeted specifically as a journalist or whether all of us as international journalists who stay at this hotel were being targeted. But it was the third strike on this block in 2 months. Thank God no one was killed or injured this time, as opposed to last time at least one, I believe one civilian was murdered, was killed in what can really only be described as a terrorist attack. There are no military installations here in front of this block, in front of this hotel. It's a civilian area. So, you know, to me, I think in some ways the video speaks for itself, but I feel personally incredibly blessed to have gotten a chance to see this from, I won't say a safe distance, but at least out of the immediate blast radius. I wasn't hit with any shrapnel. I wasn't killed. I wasn't injured. And when I came back inside, you know, after everyone else came up, I got a chance to kind of decompress. And we ended up, me and other guests and other journalists and even the hotel staff, kind of standing around and drinking some whiskey and kind of discussing what had happened and what I got from my colleagues and from, you know, my friends. I consider those people friends now because we went through a pretty traumatic experience together. They said, welcome to Donetsk. They said, you survived your baptism by fire, you know, welcome to Donetsk. And to me, it's just, it's breathtaking. And honestly, I want to note that you guys are probably the biggest sort of American Western platform that I've been invited on. No one from Western media has really reached out to me about this experience. I think if this had happened on the other side of the front line, this would be something that was replayed in mainstream media for weeks. But instead, you know, I've only really spoken to you guys. I've spoken to Russian media. I've spoken to a pretty big Indian TV channel. I've spoken to Iranian media. But it doesn't seem like anybody in the West really cares about, you know, my near-death experience at the hands of the Zelensky regime.
Except for, I know you've spoken to some smaller outlets, right?
Yeah. You guys are the biggest one, but, you know, I've spoken to Danny Haifong. I just got off an interview with him with the Black Agenda Report podcast. And, you know, outside of you guys, yeah, it's this is it.
Well, that's a reflection of the refusal in Western media to acknowledge the suffering of people in the place where you are, which is Donetsk, which along with Luhansk revolted against the US-backed coup government in 2014 and have been under fire for the last 8 years, as you say. But for people who aren't familiar with that history, you're saying that what you experienced is a taste of what people have been living under since 2014 in the area where you are. Can you give just us a quick background of what that experience has been like and why they've been under fire, why they've been facing attacks for the last 8 years?
People here have been experiencing these attacks because they are perceived as being pro-Russian. They are perceived as being traitors to the quote-unquote Ukrainian cause. So they are subjected to these attacks as kind of a punitive measure, as a way of trying to punish them for their decisions, their refusal, rather, to submit to the whims of the regime in Kiev, really of the whims of Washington and of the United Kingdom, because that's really who kind of controls the situation. That's who pulls the strings. What we're witnessing now is kind of the inevitable conclusion, I would say, of not just things that have been set in motion since this civil war started in 2014, but really going back to 2006 is when I would kind of say this got set in motion, when the United States insisted and declared that Ukraine and Georgia would become part of NATO. And this decision to basically at any costs pull Ukraine away from the Russian orbit and into the Western orbit had some predictable consequences. And, you know, it's not just me. As somebody, you know, I work for Sputnik. And so I get frequently disparaged as being like a Kremlin puppet, a Putin propagandist. But it's not me who's just saying this, right? This is something that you can find from Henry Kissinger. You can find former heads of the CIA explaining this. Basically, the idea that Ukraine is the brightest of all red lines for Russia, that this decision, despite any potential consequences, to yank Ukraine away from some kind of sphere of influence of Russia and pull it back into the Western orbit, this is something that people have been warning against a long time. Those in the know understood that this was kind of a declaration of war, because Ukraine isn't just any country. This is not Iraq. This is not Afghanistan. This is not Syria. This is not Libya. This is not some country far off, 5,000 kilometers away. This is right on Russia's border. And more importantly, this is the country, this is the entity through which the most recent invasions of Russia by the West have come, be that by Napoleon or be that by Hitler. Every time the West wants to invade Russia, they use Ukraine. So this is an extremely sore spot, not just for Vladimir Putin, but for all Russian people. And really any president who in any way represents the interests of Russian people understands this and would feel the same way. If you got rid of Vladimir Putin somehow, if the CIA or the MI6 was able to assassinate him somehow, whoever came along after him would feel the exact same way, if not stronger, about the situation. So we don't really understand it in the West in this way. And we have this sense that, this is an imperialist war, a war of adventure, a war of conquest. Russia wants to come in and just take over Ukraine. They want to recreate the Soviet Empire. That is not at all how it is seen in Russia. It's certainly not how it's seen here in Donetsk, where people very clearly and openly view Russian forces as liberators. They view them as the force which is protecting them from this Zelensky regime, which, you know, I heard and had been told wanted to kill them. And now I know firsthand, personally, for myself, wants to kill not just the civilians in Donetsk, but anybody who comes here to tell their story.
But what have they told you about what the last 8 years have been like in this civil war?
It's been what I experienced. It's been this same thing happening over and over and over again. It's been 15,000 people have died. Before February 24th, there were 15,000 casualties in this region, and 80% of them were on the Russian side. So this is nothing new to people here. In many ways, you know, I kind of explain my experience to people, everyday average citizens, people on the street, people who work at the hotel, and they're all kind of like, oh, wow, that happened to you too. Huh. So how did it feel like? It wasn't, nobody was shocked. Nobody is surprised. Nobody expressed any kind of alarm or dismay. It was just kind of like, wow, I guess they'll come after you guys too. And, you know, as an American here, on some level, I expected to be treated with a level of maybe distrust. But instead, I've been treated with kindness, with openness, with people greeting me and saying, oh, kind of thank God somebody here for the first time. There's an American here, somebody who can kind of help portray what's happening, help explain the reality of the situation to Western audiences. It's very similar to the experience, the way that I've been received in Latin America, which is I went down, you know, the first times I went to Latin American countries where there's this legacy of U.S. imperialism, of people living under the boot of either the United States itself or of a dictator that they have appointed to run their affairs, people generally treat me in a shockingly kind manner, in a way that I personally, I feel like if I were in their position, would not behave. But people generally, not just here, but all throughout Russia, have positive feelings about American people. They view us in some ways as kind of brotherly people. They view similarities in our culture and our way of acting and talking, our sense of humor. But they understand, as I do, that we are being led around by a government that doesn't represent our interests. Just like the people in Ukraine are being led around by a government that does not represent their interests. If they did, they would be seeking peace instead of specifically passing legislation to prevent it. Instead of, I mean, and it's not even just Zelensky that has this position of we will not negotiate with Vladimir Putin. We won't negotiate with the Russians until there's regime change in Russia. This is the position of the United States. This is the position of the UK. As you both know, in April, there was an attempt to sit down and negotiate a peace agreement, and scuttled by then UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who came to Kiev and said, well, Ukrainians may be ready to negotiate, but the UK government is not. And that's kind of how the dynamic really plays out. It doesn't actually matter what Ukrainian people want. What matters is that at this point, they are basically viewed as expendable in the same sense that I would say our freedom of speech, our freedom of expression, our freedom of movement is also now viewed as expendable by this Western ruling class that is ready to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian.
Right. And we have just today, I mean, Aaron, you tweeted out this, the Washington Post is reporting that privately U.S. officials say neither Russia nor Ukraine is capable of winning the war outright, but they have ruled out the idea of pushing or even nudging Ukraine to the negotiating table. It's not even disputable, the fact that the U.S. is not trying to push for negotiation or diplomacy.
They're not just not willing to negotiate. They're going to actively sabotage and actively scuttle any attempts to negotiate by Zelensky and company. Not that I think any are forthcoming at this point, but to me, it's kind of reminiscent of what Julian Assange said when he explained the war in Afghanistan. He said, it's not about winning the war. The goal is not to beat, to win the war in Afghanistan. The goal is an endless war. The goal is to have a situation in which the United States government, and more importantly, its backers and its funders, have this opportunity to sell tremendous amounts of weapons and to launder basically the money, the tax base of the US citizenry, back into the coffers of this kind of transnational elite and of these defense contractors that really call the shots at the end of the day.
And what else is, stands out to you while you're there on the ground?
Well, just from being here in Donetsk, what stands out is we're in a war zone. As you can tell, internet is not great. I haven't had water since the night that I got here. Running water is very hard to come by. There are constant artillery sounds in the background because we're about less than 10 miles from the front line. So what stands out to me is basically just the way that people have been forced to live under these conditions for, in many cases, for young people for most of their lives. And what stood out to me, because I didn't come here directly, I actually came earlier in late September, witness and report on the referendums in these four regions, which recently voted to realign with the Russian Federation in votes which have been panned and described as illegal annexations by Western media, which have been mocked as, you know, fake elections. They say that, you know, how could 90% of all these people vote in favor of all this? Well, first of all, it's not 90% of the entire population. I will say, you know, this isn't obviously the ideal circumstances to hold this kind of referendum. You are dealing with a situation where there's active hostilities. You're dealing with a situation where there's massive displacement. But those that did come out and vote, voted overwhelmingly in favor of it. And in terms of my personal experience with that, I did not see anybody being forced at gunpoint by some Spetsnaz with an AK to the back of their head to go vote. What I saw overwhelmingly was people who expressed to me, those that I interviewed, I spoke with dozens of people, and those that were willing to be interviewed told me basically this is our first chance at real self-determination. They said that we have been deprived of our basic liberties, our basic ability to function as human beings. We haven't had access to food and jobs and water and education, roads, energy, gas, all of these things that people in a modern society expect and need to survive and to thrive. They expressed in a way that I don't see in the United States, I should say, a real determination to go out and vote for this at any cost, knowing that there would be retribution by Kiev forces. So my interactions with them were very emotional. I spoke with a woman and her 81-year-old mother who both broke down in tears about 45 seconds into my interview with them. When I asked them, why did they come out? What does it feel like to have voted? This woman said, my mother has been, I spent 2 weeks searching for her. She was trapped in a basement for 2 months, and only friends from Moscow helped her. Nobody from Kiev wanted to help us. Only friends from Moscow helped us. I spoke, they had to end the interview at there because they both broke down in tears and they said, we can't, I'm sorry. And then I spoke later in Sevastopol, in Crimea, with an elderly gentleman, about 70 years old. He said, my son is serving in the Russian Federation forces. He's on the front lines. And through tears, he said, I wish that these so-called Western journalists that are saying all of this about this situation would have to spend just one day in my shoes, because I know if they did, they would never be saying the type of stuff that they spew every day.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com. Well, that was really interesting.
Yeah, and we're sorry, everybody. There were some glitches at times because, of course, Wyatt's reporting from a war zone, so the internet is not going to be great. But hopefully people got a sense of what it's like there on the other side of the war that we don't see here in the U.S. and other parts of the West.
Really interesting perspective. Also, RIP to Angela Lansbury, the amazing actress, probably most famous for Murder, She Wrote. But did you know this, Aaron? She was actually the granddaughter of a renowned British socialist, George Lansbury, and she herself identified as a socialist. She said, I'm an actress and I'm also a socialist.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, it's a real whodunit. A real mystery has been solved.
The mystery over whether Angela Lansbury was a socialist?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Wow.
Could have been an episode of Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah. All right. Well, for more, you can go to usefulidiots.substack.com. And follow us on the social media platforms that you use, whatever they are. And we'll see you next time.
Yeah. And make sure you rate and review us on the podcast and subscribe to us on YouTube and like our videos.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Hello. Thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.